from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, New York Times op-ed columnist and 2008 Nobel Prize winner in economics, Paul Krugman, has written a new book called End This Depression Now. And in it, he identifies the main problems with our nation's sluggish economy and says that Keynesian principles might be the key to jumpstarting it. We'll talk with Krugman about what he thinks the future holds for both Wall Street and Main Street. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Best-selling author, columnist, and blogger for the New York Times, Paul Krugman is the recipient of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics for research he did on trade. And he's professor of economics at Princeton as well as centenary professor at the London School of Economics. Published a book recently called End This Depression Now and joins us in studio for the second Forum Hour. And good to see you again. Welcome.
Good to be back here.
Well, and this depression. Some would say, come on, Krasny, you were talking about depression in the last hour. That's Greece. That's not us.
Okay. So I've got a – why am I using the D word in the title of the book? First of all, there is an important distinction between a recession and a depression. A recession is when things are going down. A depression is when things are down, right? So we have something we call the Great Depression, which is the 30s and more than a decade. And there are periods when the economy was growing in there, but it was never enough to make up for the terrible times, the terrible recessions, the two recessions that took place. So it was a long period of sustained, extremely high unemployment and vast misery. Well, that's what we're having right now. It's not as bad as the Great Depression. So there's a winning slogan, right? Not as bad as the Great Depression, but it's pretty terrible. It's actually awful, terrible times for
you think the president can use that as a theme?
I think that's probably not a good election slogan. But it is. No, you know, so almost 4 million Americans have been out of work for more than a year, which is something that hasn't happened since the Great Depression. Recent graduates of college are facing an abysmal labor market. So this is a sustained thing. It's been going on for years. And so I'm calling it a depression because I think that's much better at conveying the sense of what we're going through than to talk about the technical recession, which ended in 2009. But obviously, the misery has not ended.
Whatever we're going through, you say, simple Keynesian economics, spend.
That's right. It's as easy – the economics of getting out of this are remarkably easy. If we would just – actually, at this point, one of the points I make in End This Depression Now in the book is that at this point, we don't even have to have a complicated stimulus plan. All we need to do is reverse the austerity, the cuts in spending that have been taking place at the state and local level, rehire those school teachers, get back those firefighters and police officers, fill those potholes, and we'd be back a long way towards full employment. So it's actually the extremely easy. The problem is in our politics and in our minds, not in the economy itself.
The problem is the politics have gridlock. We just had Norman Ornstein and Tom Mann on last week, and
right,
they said we've never been in such terrible gridlock politically.
That's right. We have gridlock, but it's not – first of all, it's not just gridlock. We actually had mistaken ideas even on the part of the Obama administration, though they've gotten much better. The president, I think, has finally figured this thing out. But then we do have terrible political gridlock. But this is a good reason to say, okay, it is not – some deep structural problem with the economy that's holding us back. It's those people in Congress who are refusing to do the obvious and easy steps that would end this depression now.
There's still this argument that comes across, for example, from conservatives and from trickle-down supply-side economists and so forth who say things like if you're spending more, it's just going to get you more and more into debt and you're hocking the future or putting it away for our next generations. And in fact, just heard somebody going through one of these discourses about the difference in Europe is that Europe has had higher taxes and that's why they're in trouble. The job creators can't have the freedom that they presume they have here.
Yeah. On the European thing, I think it's amazing. I've discovered that in the last few weeks, conservatives have in this country have decided that their great role model is Sweden, which is, in fact, doing relatively well in this
somewhat
thing.
Socialist.
Yeah, yeah, it's taxes. Have you thought about what the tax level is like in Sweden and the level of the welfare state? Now, and by the way, that's the counterexample, right? There is the arguably the most generous welfare state in the world still, and they're weathering the crisis just fine. Whereas Ireland, which was a great role model, it was, you know, it was the highest ranked Western country on the Heritage Foundation's Index of Economic Freedom, and they're in a disaster. So it has nothing to do with the welfare state, everything to do with bad policies. And about the future, I mean, if you're really worried about the future, you should be worried about college graduates who can't find jobs that make any – by and large can't find jobs at all. And if they can, that make no use of their skill, which means that we are essentially sacrificing the future for a whole cohort, maybe a whole generation of young people. Should be worried about older workers who've been unemployed so long they may never be able to be employed again. Those costs for the future are much bigger than the cost of paying interest on a little bit more debt right now, especially when interest rates, you know, the U.S. government can borrow so cheaply.
But you're also talking about banks making credit easier. In addition to spending, you're talking about putting money into the infrastructure, spending pretty much across the board.
That's right. I mean, think about it. Some people say, well, let's run the government like a business. Well, if the government was a business and you said, okay, what we've got right now is we've got borrowing costs that are at historic lows. It's incredibly cheap for the federal government to borrow. In fact, if they're willing to issue inflation-protected bonds, the interest rate is negative. People are willing to actually pay the federal government to hold the value of their savings safe. Lots of unmet needs. Lots of unmet needs that are both long-term investments but also just a lot of short-term maintenance that's being neglected and education of our children that's being neglected. The workers that we would employ to do these things would otherwise be doing nothing. This is a time when any sensible business would say this is a really good time to be spending on the future of the business. And instead, we're cutting back. It's crazy.
And regulation? I mean, you said Dodd-Frank maybe even has to be more stringent than it is. We go back to Glass-Steagall. And yet, many who are talking about the tax system, I mean, are we not doing anything or do we not need to do anything about all the loopholes and the giveaways and the lower rates for the rich? And
oh, sure. But I think it is important. It's really important to understand that there's a difference between ending this depression now and fixing our long-run problems. And you need to do both of those, but what you need to do first of all is end the depression we're in. And the point is that those are not at all the same thing. I use a metaphor there. Back in the 30s, John Maynard Keynes said we have magneto trouble, which is an old-fashioned term, problems with the electrical system of the car. It's like we have a car, $30,000 car with a dead battery. And for $100, we could replace that battery and have the car running again. Now, the car may need a lot of maintenance. In fact, it does beyond that. But the first thing is replace the darn battery and get the car moving again.
What about debt, though? I mean, we get more and more indebted, and we may not be able to get out of it. I think it was Kenneth Rogoff who said the pain of debt in the long run on the economy is just something that we can't withstand.
I think, first of all, I could get too deep into the weeds. I think Ken Rogoff is a good economist, but this time he's got his causation backwards. High debt economies tend to have low growth, but that's mostly because low growth economies tend to have high debt, not the other way around. But the main thing right now is that actually skimping on spending, cutting back on spending right now doesn't even help you on the debt side. Because, yeah, it means you spend less, but it also shrinks the economy, which means less tax revenue. The weak economy inflicts damage on our long-term prospects too. All those college graduates who can't find jobs are never going to be as productive as they should have been. All of those workers who've been unemployed for a year who will never get reemployed again, that's hurting our long run. So that the end, and which ends up hurting our long run revenue. So it's actually, I think, a pretty much slam dunk case that even in purely fiscal terms, austerity right now, slashing spending because you're worried about the debt is self-defeating. We're actually acting like medieval doctors that thought that the way to cure a disease was to bleed you. And if their patients got sicker from the bleeding, they said, oh, well, let's bleed them even more. That's what's happening with fiscal austerity right now.
Paul Krugman here with us in studio, and he is New York Times op-ed columnist, professor of economics at Princeton, and Nobel laureate in economics, author of End This Depression Now. I read your column this morning, Paul, and kind of took on Romney. We'll talk about that. But also Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan and said, Well, what an opportunity. Yeah. I mean, this, how many billions we don't even know. Mistake gives us four more regulation. But what? How do you envision regulation in this?
Okay, there's a whole bunch of things. We had a workable bank regulatory system for half a century after the 1930s. It had several elements to it. It had deposit insurance, so we did have some guarantees so you prevented old-fashioned bank runs, which is a good thing. By the way, if you've seen the scene in a movie, it's a Wonderful Life, that's actually anachronistic. That's supposed to be taking place after World War II, and it couldn't have happened because by that time we already had deposit insurance. But in return for that, you had sharp limits on the kinds of risks banks could take. You had requirements that banks have a thick enough cushion of capital, that they not be too leveraged. So a whole set of regulations, which meant that we avoided any major banking crises for half a century. Then we bought into Reagan's idea that the government is never the solution, it's always the problem, started to take away those regulations, removed Glass-Steagall so that depository institutions could start doing speculative stuff like investment banks. And I think even most crucially of all, as we started to evolve new forms of banking, shadow banking, which are things where you don't, no longer big marble buildings with rows of tellers, but other
subterranean casino banking.
Well, yeah, or actually, my favorite. My voicemail has speech transcription, which often yields funny results. So shadow banking comes across as chateau banking, which I kind of like. But
I like that too, yeah.
But no, things like repo, borrowing, someplace like Lehman Brothers was borrowing overnight to finance long-term investments, which is banking and has all the risks of standard banking but wasn't covered by the rules. So by failing to both maintain and extend that regulatory system, we opened ourselves up for a replay of what happened at the beginning of the 1930s, which is what happened in 2008. So back to reconstruct the system that is the functional equivalent of the system our grandfathers created, which worked very well for half a century.
I was really interested in reading the former chief economist of Deutsche Bank who said, if we keep living beyond our means, we're going to have to go backward. We can't go forward.
Well, but we are not actually living beyond our means. What we are doing is producing below our capacity, right? What's happening right now is that the U.S. economy is capable of producing around $1 trillion more of goods and services. We've got willing workers. We've got idle factories, empty office buildings. The thing to do is to get those things to work. I mean, people like the analogy, we're like a family that spent too much and needs to tighten its belt. I hate that belt tightening thing. But, when a family has overspent, it does not respond to overspending by quitting its jobs and becoming unemployed. And yet that's what's happened to our economy. Even if you're worried about our long-run overspending, why does that require that we have 13 million people unemployed and 4 million people out of work for more than a year? That doesn't make sense at all.
You're not as fearful of runaway inflation. I think you call it the phantom menace, and certainly Chairman Bernanke keeps talking about the fear of inflation.
Yeah, Bernanke is saying he's not actually afraid of inflation, but he's saying they can't raise the target for inflation even a bit because that would hurt their credibility, which I'm really saddened to see him say that because
in a post-Standard and Poor's world.
I'm saddened to see that because it's because there are actually some very good reasons why a slightly higher inflation target would be a good thing, reasons that were carefully explained in a 2000 paper by a fellow by the name of Ben Bernanke. As I say, I think he's been assimilated by the Borg at the Fed. He's lost what he used to know. Particularly under current conditions, inflation is just not a problem. It's not going to. We have occasional spikes in oil prices, which have nothing to do with U.S. policy. But beyond that, wages are going nowhere. This is not the 1970s. Essentially, we are not living in a replay of the 1970s. We are living in a replay of the 1930s, and we need to be focused on what the real problems are right now.
And Governor Romney doesn't offer you much in the way of salvation or hope where that's concerned. In fact, in your column this morning, you seem to intimate that he's got it totally backwards and wrong.
Yeah. I mean, Romney, I've been working on the assumption that he's a smart guy who just is willing to say anything because of his ambition. And I'm starting to reconsider the first half of that. What he said, so J.P. Morgan Chase has this big loss, and Romney's comment was, well, that's how capitalism works. And besides, somebody was on the other side of that transaction, so they made money. So where's the problem? And there's lots of things you can say about that. If a thief steals your TV set, you don't have the TV set, but he does, so what's the problem? But more the point, this is a – when banks lose lots of money, when banks – which – when a bank fails, it causes havoc in the economy, especially a giant bank like J.P. Morgan, besides which we know that J.P. Morgan would be bailed out. It has guaranteed deposits. You know, if Romney doesn't understand why out-of-control risk-taking by a too-big-to-fail bank like J.P. Morgan is a big problem for our economy, for public policy, then he has no business, you know, running for public office because he doesn't understand a thing about the economy.
I know that you and other economists like Joe Stiglitz and Bob Reich felt that the stimulus was a good idea, but it didn't go far enough. There wasn't enough spending. What do you say when talk about another Republican, John Boehner, essentially says we can't spend the money we don't have?
Boy, I mean, obviously we can, right? I haven't checked the numbers this morning, but lately the U.S. government has been able to borrow at 1.7-1.8% interest on 10-year bonds. And I said, you know, the inflation-protected bonds and negative interest rates. The bond market is saying it's perfectly okay to borrow now. We're not worried about the fiscal ability of the U.S. to handle deficits. Obviously, you can't run huge deficits forever, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an emergency situation of a deeply depressed economy. So, you know, the economic wisdom of John Boehner. Also, where was he when we were in fact running deficits when we didn't need to, when we were cutting taxes in the face of an economy that was not deeply depressed, when we were engaging in unfunded wars? Back then, I was saying, hey, don't do this. This is the time to be paying debt down, not to be running deficits. So the question is, you know, it's only now when we're actually trying to spend money for a good reason to create jobs and, of course, when there's a Democrat in the White House that he suddenly gets all huffy about deficit spending.
Talk about a Democrat in the White House. You seem to feel – I mean, you were pretty critical of President Obama the first few years. Many felt, in fact, he should have been consulting more with you than many of those who were preeminent in the Bush administration as economic advisors. But you seem to feel he's sort of got the message of Keynesian economics now?
Yeah. No, I mean, I talk to people in the administration, and there's always the question, how much are they spinning telling me what they think I want to hear, but they do seem to understand these things better. I think that they have understood that they were listening, at least to some extent, to the wrong people early on. And also, you know, there is a – so, okay, I always have to say I'm a New York Times columnist. I can't do endorsements, so you have no idea who I'd like to see win this election. But there, it's not ideal, but I understand the political constraints that the president's under, and you know, things are terrible, but they could be worse. And if Mitt Romney has a chance, they will be worse.
Do you think he's going to lead us right toward Greece as far as a path ahead? I think that's what I read you as saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly yeah. I mean, look, we have an example in Britain where they like us have had no problem borrowing. There was no need for immediate slashing of spending, but the Cameron government in Britain decided that they were going to do it anyway because they believed in the confidence fairy. They believed that they slash spending, that people will become more confident and the economy will actually expand. And the result is they've gotten themselves into a double dip recession. And actually, the worst of their austerity hasn't even bitten yet. So they've really done a lot of damage, and they're disinvesting. They've slashed their public investment. So they're doing a lot of damage. And what we have basically is the Republican Party platform is to do the same thing, only more so, while cutting taxes on rich people, of course. And so it is a path. You know, it would take a lot of doing to turn us into a full Greek scale crisis, but they'd certainly make a good faith try to do that.
On the other side of the coin, I suppose you see, for example, Iceland and Japan coming back because they're spending.
Now, Japan is a particular. I like to look at Japan had a good first quarter, just a good first quarter. They, obviously, they're not doing well, and they've been in trouble for a long time. But the interesting thing is they did have a good first quarter because they were spending for reconstruction from the tsunami, which is just an illustration that in depression conditions, more spending actually boosts the economy. It's not saying that Japan has a good general policy environment. Iceland is a fascinating example. It was ground zero of the financial crisis. It was supposed to be the total disaster area. They had the good luck to have so severe a crisis that they could not be orthodox. They could not even try to do the things a good a responsible government, a very serious capital V, capital S government was supposed to do. So they repudiated the debt that their banks ran up. They devalued their currency. And they have lower unemployment than we do right now. They've actually weathered the crisis very, very well.
I'm amazed at Australia's rate of unemployment. It's about 4.3%, even though the prime minister is losing in the polls in terms of popularity, 18%. Go figure. I mean, what would Obama do to have that kind of rate of unemployment?
Well, yeah, it's a long story. But Australia's been in a very different universe. And they are, after all, a raw material exporter in a time of high raw material prices. So I'm not sure there are too many lessons for us right now.
Talking with Paul Krugman, and let me tell you how you can join this conversation. We do welcome your phone calls. Our toll-free number is available, 866-733-6786. So feel free to join this program. You're cordially invited to do so. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or you can also communicate with us by going to our Facebook page. Jeffrey Sachs, who is a man with a good deal of gravitas, talked about essentially what you're spelling out as the method of remedying some of our economic problems as, I think he said, crude Keynesian pump priming economics.
Yeah, I've been saying the next guy who calls me crude, I'm going to punch him in the nose. No, it's not.
You're saying a crude oil, maybe.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's not crude. There are times when, and I think this is what – I don't know where Jeff's coming from here. But there are times when – look, it always sounds sophisticated and serious and hard-headed to say, well, we need to work on the long run, not the short run. But sometimes that's exactly wrong. Right now what we have is a catastrophic short-run problem which will do enormous long-run damage. So it's like saying that we shouldn't deal with the short run. It's like saying, you know, your house is burning down. You're saying, well, we need to talk about fire regulations instead of, you know, calling the fire department and putting out the fire. So right now we really do need to act. And there's nothing crude about it. This is the essential thing to do. And I don't quite understand why. Well, we won't need to get into personalities, but it's again, John Maynard Keynes had the great quote. He said people talk about the long run and how in the long run these things will work out. He said in the long run we're all dead. Not to say we shouldn't care about the long run, but that, you know, he said economists set themselves too useless a task if they only talk about how things will work out in the long run when in fact the crisis is now.
Is there a crisis, though, the possibility of U.S. defaulting on its national debt?
I think that's very – well, actually, I shouldn't say that. If we default on our debt, it will only be because Republicans want us to. The United States has no problem with paying its bills. We cannot actually we among other things, if our debt's in dollars, we print dollars. This is not – you know, this is not a problem we have. There's essentially no possibility of a U.S. default except as a result of hostage-taking politics on the part of the Republican Party. It's just not going to happen.
We're talking with a nonpartisan columnist for the New York Times, Paul Krugman. Well, actually, do you get flack about that, being the lib and being the Democratic stalking horse or something along those lines a lot?
Well, I mean, from whom? I mean, obviously, I get lots of.
Talk about your newspaper.
The newspaper expects us to have points of view, right? As I said, we can't do direct endorsements because then somebody can misquote and say the New York Times has endorsed when in fact it's not the New York Times; it's David Brooks who endorsed it. We can't do that. So, but if we didn't have point of view, what are you doing on the op-ed page?
Well, we're going to give you an opportunity to do your own editorializing or join us with any questions or comments when we return. We'll hear from you, and again, you can join us by toll-free number 866-733-6786 or emailing forum@kqed.org or posting any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. We'll continue with Paul Krugman. His new book is End This Depression Now. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking with Paul Krugman, New York Times op-ed columnist and 2008 Nobel Prize winner in economics, who has written a new book called End This Depression Now. And in it, he identifies the main problems with our nation's sluggish economy and says that Keynesian principles just might be the key to fixing it. I'm talking with him about what he thinks the future will be for Wall Street and Main Street, and we'll have you join us in just a moment here. I wanted to get to a, I think, important point in this political season that we're in, and that is You pretty much hold the Republicans' feet to the fire. You said that, you know, Romney would be leading us absolutely in the wrong direction, intimated that maybe he's not even as bright as you thought, get back to the reason we've got in this mess in the first place. And you usually talk about the wars, the Bush tax cuts, and, well, economics under Bush. How much really of this responsibility is President Obama's? I mean, in terms of lack of leadership, you say he maybe gets it now, but having appointed the wrong people and maybe not being all that conversant with the world of economics, how much of it really is on his shoulders?
Well, there's an unanswerable question, which is whether he could have gotten a more ambitious program right at the beginning. He certainly came in with a proposal that was too small. And then there's the question, was that the most he could possibly have gotten? He certainly bobbled housing debt relief, which has been one of the big failures of the administration. And he was slow to fill seats on the Federal Reserve Board. So a bunch of things. He played much too much to the Republican conservative worldview until basically last fall. So he's not ideal, right? And mistakes were made. To some extent, he trusted the wrong people, I would say. But, you know, I guess I'd say you go to a depression with the politicians you have, not the politicians you want, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld. Would I like to have seen someone who was, who got it, who saw everything my way, which of course is the right way, but who saw that way right from the beginning? Sure. But FDR made big mistakes too. FDR disastrously listened to the 1930s equivalent of today's austerity fiends back in 1937 and sent the economy into a second major down leg. So, sure, I have a lot of criticism, but it doesn't seem like that's the key thing we should be focusing on right now. Just try to get him to do better if he's reelected.
Well, and also, I think you've talked about a priority of putting people back to work. You mentioned before school teachers, fire,
right,
and police, public servants, and so forth. Let's go to some emails here. First, Chris writes, does Paul Krugman have any advice for California? Can California solve its problems separate from U.S. stimulus?
The answer is no. I mean, you can do some things, and I think there's a lot of reason to believe that states are better advised to meet their fiscal crisis, at least partly by raising taxes, not just by cutting spending, which of course is very hard given the California, the constitutional mess California is in.
We were in that mess even before Norquist laid down.
I know. California, in a lot of ways, California, you know, led the nation into its current state of disaster. But there's even aside from that, there's a limited amount you can do. I mean, it's pretty much the same thing, by the way, for the prime minister of a small European country. How much can he do? Well, there at least they have the nuclear option of leaving the euro, but that's a huge step to take. And of course, California doesn't even have anything like that. So no, I mean I'm willing to cut governors a lot of slack because there's only so much they can do. I'm willing to cut governors a lot of slack, except my governor. Governor yells at people of New Jersey, who really is doing disastrous things.
Jerry Brown's become kind of an austerian, though, in some ways.
Well, he sort of
has to.
Yeah? He has to. I know. But actually, I have to say, I'm feeling really old that Jerry Brown is governor of California again, and he's an austerity advocate. What happened to my generation?
It's called metamorphosis, I think. Now, whether that's a good metamorphosis or not, we'll have to leave to the judgment of the people. But we go on to some more emails here. David writes, will the government borrowing to stimulate demand cause a long-term improvement in the economy when the economy's underlying institutions seem to be dysfunctional? That seems to be trying to prime a pump with terribly leaky seals. For instance, outside my windows, the city of Mountain View is replacing a water main with labor artificially priced far above its global value, perhaps $100 per hour. If we could reprice domestic labor more flexibly, Mountain View could hire many more people, each at lower pay, and fix many more water mains or hire more teachers. Is the institutional infrastructure in such bad shape that pump priming won't work? Are we doomed to muddle along until things get really bad and people fix the underlying institutions of the economy?
So, okay. First of all, I wanted to ban pump priming as a metaphor because nobody in modern America knows what that means. Call it jump starting instead.
We'll ban crude as well, yes.
Right. But bear in mind, mostly what we're talking about now is rehiring school teachers. Actually, school teachers. I mean, the representative public employee is a school teacher. And are school teachers, are public employees in general, vastly overpaid? And the answer is no, they're not. We've actually had a number of studies. Depending on exactly how you cut the numbers, you can move it a few percent either way. But basically, public employees are paid about what you'd expect given their education levels. And it's not the case that we have vastly overpaid public employees.
However, the pensions, and they keep looming, don't they?
That's a real issue, but it's one of those exaggerated issues. You actually look at it, and yeah, there's a problem. Public pensions are underfunded. So, by the way, are private pensions. So is a lot of stuff in this economy. That's one of those issues that needs to be dealt with, but it's not relevant to the immediate mess we're in. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that spending more would not create a lot more employment right now. There's we've got a lot of we've actually done what we've seen is the experience with spending cuts. We've basically carried out a massive unethical human experiment in Europe and to some extent in the United States of the effects of spending cuts. And guess what? They destroy jobs, which says that reversing those spending cuts would bring those jobs back.
And then we have the GOP saying if you impose any kind of tax, you hurt job creation.
Yeah.
So where's that equation even come from? I've never quite figured it.
So that's why the economy tanked after President Clinton raised taxes, right? And why we had such a wonderful decade after George W. Bush cut taxes. And for that matter, it's why America was such a disaster area back in the days of that socialist Dwight Eisenhower, when the top marginal tax rate was actually 91%. Right? I mean, nothing in history supports that. There's not a shred of evidence for that position. The question then is why do people keep on,
a fundamentalist belief almost.
Well,
right?
But it comes back to that great California person from a long ago, Upton Sinclair, who said that it's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. There's a lot of money behind promoting that belief.
Here's a web comment. Listener says, the government has been running trillion-dollar deficits for 4 years now. If that isn't enough Keynesian stimulus, how much would it take?
Those deficits are overwhelmingly the result of the depressed economy. We have big deficits because tax receipts are at a historic low. We haven't had this little government revenue collection as a share of GDP for generations because the economy is so depressed. So that's not stimulative. That's just saying that the economy is depressed. And if you actually look at real government spending, you look at actual government purchases of stuff, purchases of goods and services, which are the thing that matter most, they've been in an unprecedented decline, right? If you compare public sector employment under Barack Obama so far with public sector employment during George W. Bush's first term. If we continue to grow public sector employment with population, which is more or less what happened under Bush, we'd have added 700,000 jobs. Instead, we've subtracted 600,000. So the actual picture is one of unprecedented government cutbacks, not spending. And yes, we have budget deficits because the economy is in the tank.
Let me go to our callers. We go first to Brandon. Good morning.
Hey, guys. Good morning. I've heard so many things mentioned. First, I just want to briefly say that whole thing with the basically it's a Republican ploy, I feel, to just correlate job creators with not, you know, as a rationale for not cutting taxes on the wealthy. But what I wanted to ask is, Mr. Krugman, what debt to GDP ratio do you think America could hit before the Fed becomes the primary purchaser of treasuries?
Wow. So actually, you know, on and off during recent years, the Fed actually has been the primary purchaser of treasuries. But so what? The point is we're not actually relying on the printing press to pay our bills. We don't need to. I can't give you a hard number, but we have a lot of historical evidence. We know that Britain had debt levels well above ours as a share of GDP for most of the 20th century because they ran up a lot of debts during World War I and then a lot more during World War II with never a catastrophe. We know that Japan has a debt that's 200% of GDP and they're still able to borrow long term at an interest rate of less than 1%. So advanced countries that print their own currencies and borrow in their own currencies get cut a lot of slack. I don't know where that red line is, even if there is a red line, but it's a long way from where we are right now. So this is not what you should be worrying about at this point in time.
Thank you, Brandon. Paul Krugman with us in studio. End this depression now, and let's go to John. John, join us.
Hey, Dr. Krugman. It seems like we spend an enormous amount of money on military spending, and that's a very large portion of our discretionary spending. My question is, would we be far better off economically if we converted that money and invested it in infrastructure, education, all those productive areas that would help us build up the economy? I guess my question partly is, it seems that military spending is about the least productive spending that we could be making.
Yeah, so I'm... You know, when people talk about waste and fraud in government, mostly they have no idea what they're talking about. The U.S. government is basically it's a giant insurance company with an army. That's the description I like of it, which is about right. And the insurance parts of it are pretty efficient. Social Security is a very efficient system. Medicare has problems, but those problems have to do with the U.S. healthcare system in general, not Medicare in particular, which is actually more efficient than the private insurance companies. So if you want a place where there is really a lot of inefficiency, a lot of sheer waste, it is in fact defense spending. So if you're looking for ways to cut, both to eliminate spending we don't need and to eliminate extremely corrupt and inefficient spending, even on things we do need, the defense is where to go.
Look at what just happened a couple of weeks ago under Boehner's leadership, though. Defense, they wanted more
right.
money, and they got more money at the expense of Meals on Wheels and food
right.
stamps.
They're getting more money even though the military itself says we don't need it. And you know, we're getting and the stories about $17,000 drip pans or whatever continue to – so fine. Now, and I'd like to see if we could eliminate a fair bit of that waste and ask ourselves what do we really need in terms of defense and use that for productive things, we would be better off. Again, though, that's not the core of where we are right now. I mean, we had a lot of wasteful defense spending 5 years ago, but we weren't in a depression. So the important point, I think, is to say this is another one of those things that we ought to fix, but it's not about what it takes to end this depression right now.
Let me thank the caller. When I talked about tax loopholes with you before, you spoke really about the urgency, the immediacy of needing to spend and needing to move into this Keynesian realm. I'm just wondering, though, about things like – I mean, you have even pointed out that there are a lot of CEOs who are terribly overinflated in their salaries.
Right.
We have a system with bank fraud and casino capitalism and junk mortgages that are still pretty much operative. I mean, we're talking about – a whole system here, aren't we?
Yeah. And there's a maybe a little historical parallel. What did it, we ended the Great Depression by basically with large-scale government spending, otherwise known as World War II, or actually more accurately, we were out of it before we entered the war, but the defense buildup before the war is what took us out of the Great Depression. Our ability to stay out of another Great Depression for 60 years after all of that, I think had a lot to do with us having become a more equal, more just society. The reduced income inequality made it possible to have a more functional political system. When we talk about partisanship and gridlock in Congress, that's very closely tied, very closely correlated anyway with income inequality. So this extremely unequal economic system, which distorts our political system, and then the politics feeds back into the income inequality. That's part of our underlying problem. And so, if we want to achieve a durable fix for this depression, we're going to have to address income inequality next. But by all means, I mean, I think if you want to trace the horrible, the totally dysfunctional response we've had to this crisis. If you want to understand the roots of it, then that extreme inequality, the runaway economic elite is an important part of the story, and we shouldn't forget that.
Now, here's a web comment along those lines. Listener writes, the 1% lackeys in the think tanks, academia, and Congress are effective advocates of fiscal stimulus for the corporations, which receive handouts in order to keep on top and to keep the competition down. They will not give away the advantage to the 99% or to smaller companies ever. Instead, they are forever seeking an austerity solution for America, which indeed they started implementing long ago with the dismantling of welfare under Clinton and before that with the dismantling of public health services under Nixon.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sympathetic. And by the way, would that it were the 1%. It's actually the 0.1 and the 0.01% that are really calling the shots here. But you have to – America, okay, I guess in the end I do believe in America. We have shown a capacity for renewal and reform over the centuries. And I don't think that the power of that elite is insurmountable. It's tough. And you have to say that it's going to be not easy to get things right. But that's not the same thing as saying that there is no hope, that we can't fix this unless we rebuild the thing from the ground up. I think, you know, we have been here before and we did get out of it, and you have to keep on trying to fix it starting from where we are now.
Well, we've never been in such a political cul-de-sac or such a political stalemate.
Actually, yes, I think we have in the past, although maybe this is worse than ever. But you know, America in the early 30s was a pretty bad place. And so, you know, we've been through a lot of and hey, you know, the 150 years ago, we had the Civil War, which I'm not recommending, but, you know, we even got through that.
We'll get to another call, and that's you, Kim. Thanks for waiting. Hi.
Thanks for being a human during what is sort of an inhumane time in America. Thanks, Paul. What I want to ask is, many years ago I read a book called by Jeremy Rifkin called The End of Work. I have a suspicion based on nothing but a hunch, and that's that at least in California we have such an oversaturated labor pool, and with technology and with a lot of the practices used by the IT industry, along with others, with you know, job outsourcing and insourcing, all the rest of that. I think we're entering a very, very dark period where there's simply not going to be enough jobs ever again in California. Where will they come from, Paul? And what is to be done? This state used to be so beautiful. It is literally if you drive around the state, look around, it used to be different. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
Rifkin did say essentially work was going out of the way because of, technical and advances in robots and all sorts of computer things. Hasn't quite lived up to those dire prophecies.
Yeah.
But
And one of the things I've done some on is to go back to the 1930s, and you'll find many people saying exactly the same thing. A lot of learned papers. I actually mentioned one of them in the Times column recently, a learned analysis from June 1939 about how technology has just made many of our workers obsolete, and there's just no way we can have a major recovery in employment. And then the war started in Europe, and the U.S. began its defense build-up, and over the next 2 years, employment rose by 20%, which would be the equivalent of 26 million jobs right now. So it's just not true that technology eliminates jobs. There is a real phenomenon which has been a kind of a hollowing out of the middle. The jobs that have been growing tend to be either very high skill or relatively low skill. And that's a little bit hard to address, though you can do a lot by first of all, by providing basic things like health coverage to everybody, regardless of what kind of job they have, and by helping workers to organize so that they can negotiate better wages, even if they're in jobs that are not necessarily ones that require a PhD. But it's an ongoing thing. But this fatalism, this notion that there just aren't enough jobs. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut wrote a novel, Player Piano, was something like 1952, about how automation destroys all the jobs. And somehow, 60 years later, there still are jobs. So this is one of those futures that keeps on not happening, and I don't think it's happening right now. And California is a mess, but California is a mess because of bad politics. It wasn't the technology that destroyed it. It's Prop 13 and all the things that followed.
Let me thank that caller and some web comments. Listener writes, you claim that Chase's loss is a good argument for regulation. What's wrong with them losing $2 billion? They made a mistake. They lost the money. Big deal. Should we regulate losses out of existence?
No, except when you have a too-big-to-fail bank. Read today's column in the New York Times, right? Actually, I go through that. But this is not a bank. First of all, a bank, and especially a giant bank like J.P. Morgan, is not like some guy. If some person, some individual, or some corporation that's not a special strategic role in the economy makes a mistake, fine. That's life. But if a bank fails, it's going to have a hugely disruptive effect on the economy, which is why, by and large, we don't let banks fail, which is why we bail them out if they're in big trouble, especially if they're giant banks like J.P. Morgan, which is why we have deposit insurance, which is why if you're going to be a public trust like that, which banks are, then they have to be subjected to rules that say that they cannot take on excessive risks.
Well, FDIC does a lot of protecting, but here's a web comment that says, why are we bailing out private banks? I can understand bailing out public banks, of which only one exists in the USA, Bank of North Dakota, but private banks don't operate in the public's interest. They compete.
No, but when they fail. I mean, look, in fact, we did this experiment, right? Lehman Brothers, which was a shadow bank. Lehman Brothers wasn't taking deposits, but by financing itself with in the repo market, which is in effect a kind of shadow money, it was effectively acting as a bank, and there was a lot of Lehman was in trouble, and at least the initial reaction was, okay, well, that's not our problem, let's let it fail. 3 days later, looked like the world was about to end. The disruption in world financial markets was so great that it looked like we were actually heading for a full replay of the Great Depression. So we tried that experiment, and we discovered that actually banks are different, and you can't just let them fail.
Listening to Forum, we're talking with Paul Krugman this hour. His new book is End This Depression Now, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we go to another caller from Stockton. Bill, you're on.
Hi, how you doing? Listen, I think the way to end the depression now is to use natural gas because it's 2 bits a gallon, and we have 8 million obsolete diesel trucks on the road. If we converted them to natural gas, they'd save $50,000 a year in fuel. And I think when you have orders for 8 million new trucks to use natural gas, that would pretty much boost the economy. And also, Harold Hamm in the Wall Street Journal said, if we go to natural gas, there'll be $18 trillion in royalties, and it will pay off the national debt.
Wow. Okay, it's not that easy to just replace. And by the way, are you talking about ordering people to replace, to scrap all those vehicles? I thought we were, that's a little bit of government intervention of a level even I wouldn't support. But also, look, the natural gas abundance that we suddenly have is the result of new technology, fracking, which is an interesting and impressive technology, but is also coming at serious environmental cost, and we're not pricing in those costs properly. I wouldn't necessarily ban the practice, but I think we do need to require that there be an accounting for it, and we haven't even figured out just how bad those are. So the idea that there's a magic technological bullet there, I think, is wrong.
Let me thank the caller and go to another web comment. Listener writes, it's not just college students who can't find jobs. Silicon Valley is full of older workers who have up-to-date skills and experience but have been categorically discriminated against and excluded. If I were in their shoes, I would seriously consider teaching technology skills in China and helping native companies there that have the wherewithal to compete against American firms, against the companies who shunned older American workers.
Oh, sure. I mean, everyone who's suffering deserves enormous sympathy and anger on their behalf because this doesn't have to be happening. But the two groups that tear my heart out are, on the one hand, the young graduates who are not getting started on their lives, and we have some evidence that they will never recover.
If you graduate, are terribly in debt.
That's right. They've graduated with all of this debt, and now they're working part-time as a barista or something. And that's a horrible thing. But the other thing is older workers who have lost their jobs and have no realistic prospects of retirement. And I do know people my age, I'm 59, who are out of it. Their lives have just been destroyed, and they have no realistic prospect of ever getting another job. And all they can do is hope to hang on until they can get their Social Security and their Medicare if the Republicans allow those programs to survive.
What about debt relief for the college students? And what about programs to redeploy that workforce that we're talking about that's elderly or that's up in years over 60?
Well, first of all, debt relief, yes. I mean, I haven't had a time. I haven't worked out what formula I would support. But yes, I mean, there's a very strong case for home mortgage debt relief, and there's a very strong case for student debt relief. This is part of what's holding our economy – aside from just the human side of it, this is part of what's holding our economy back, and we should be doing whatever we can. I'm not sure we need to redeploy workers. We need to boost this economy. And you know, when the economy is doing well, older workers with a lot of useful experience are – many of them can find jobs. So, you know, end this depression, and then we'll be solving a lot of those problems right there.
That's the title of the book, End This Depression. Paul Krugman with us, and so is Thomas from up in Jenner. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Mr. Krugman. I wondered who you think benefits from the, you know, the banks being allowed to steal the money and invest it poorly and get bailed out and take people's homes and, you know, wars being started and then the taxes being cut on the super rich, which is what always funded that stuff. I mean, this seems to me like there must be somebody who understands this. There are people, you know, power players, you know, the Karl Roves who are funding Mitt Romney and attacking, you know, and coming up with these real convincing one-liners about the job creators and all this nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, somebody's doing that. Somebody's benefiting.
No, this
from
is
that.
Not mysterious. I mean, this you can even track
Karl Rove. I don't think has swung his support to Romney. There's been some enmity there.
Right, but I don't think it's actually it's not mysterious. It's not even if it's a conspiracy, it's a pretty open conspiracy. Look at this whole network of think tanks, giant funded propaganda campaigns and so on, and you can trace it back to around a dozen billionaires. I mean, it's not a very you know, take a look at the Koch brothers and Richard Mellon Scaif and the Bradley Foundation and all that. So it's a pretty open network, and it's considered impolite to talk about it, but that's how it works.
Paul Krugman, always good to have you with us. Thank
take
you so
care.
Much for being here with us. And again, his book is End This Depression Now. Winner of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics and columnist for the New York Times. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Christina Russo. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.